Tell me what Elmer was. You know, there's the public Elmer Sulzer. What was Elmer like, your father like, around the dinner table at night? We'll start with that.
I think probably like any normal father and with his family, relaxed and comfortable. And I don't think of him as dominating the conversation. We all talked, and he encouraged his children to do, you know, what they could. And
now, you grew up in Lexington. Talk about your experience in Lexington, Kentucky.
Let's see. I must have been, I think I was 2 weeks old when he moved to Lexington as a UK band director. I think we lived in an apartment in Limestone, and then we lived on Aylesford Place. This is probably more trivia than you need. 422 Aylesford till I was seven, then moved up to the next block for, 324 Aylesford till I was 14, and he was shoveling coal in the basement. That's how houses. The house was built in 1907. I looked all that up later. I got interested in old houses. So we moved to Chevy Chase, a new subdivision, when I was 14, and I was married at 21 or 2. So I left Lexington at that point, but he lived in Chevy Chase.
Now, you got your master's from the University of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. What was it in, and your experience with that?
In high school, of course, the war was on, and I got interested in airplanes and was building model airplanes out of, you know, balsa and whatever, and glue, and hanging them from the ceiling. And so he said, my father suggested I major in engineering. I didn't even know what it was. So I went to University of Kentucky all 4 years and nearly majored in aeronautical engineering, but decided mechanical was broader and had more possibilities, which it did.
Now, Elmer obviously was the band director first and foremost, but then there were other things that he got into. But let's talk first about his band director days.
Okay.
He was, you told me as I walked in the door that how he came to UK. Let's start there.
Oh, he worked for his father in Madison, Indiana, in a drug herb and root business, and for the first year, and then decided to apply to UK. He had majored in music and journalism at DePaul University, so this way he could use his talents. And he was accepted at the university. They already had a music department, but I don't know if they had a band or not. And I understand he was the first to have women in the band. And I think he was responsible for naming it the best band in Dixie. And he did the arrangement on UK that band used when they came on the field for many years. I remember that very well. Then he started you want me to go on?
Okay. Yeah,
the Publicity Bureau, it was first called. And a friend of mine and I helped write letters to graduates, encouraging them, of course, to come to the university. And then he got interested in radio broadcasting, I guess as part of the Publicity Bureau, and started a department, a class department there, teaching students communications and radio. And, of course, later, when television came on the scene, they added that. But it was the top floor of McVeigh Hall for many years until I left Lexington. But I remember going up there and seeing he was directing a band for an orchestra to fill in on some of the programs. I started the Radio Listening Centers. You want to hear about that?
That is what I'm dying to talk about, of course, is because out of those listening centers became the radio station that I currently work for. So let's first start with what gave him the idea of the Radio Listening Centers.
He had a lot of hobbies that might have sprung from them. I know he wrote a book that included some Stephen Collins Foster songs, and then he got interested in folk songs and interviewed people who grew up in the Kentucky mountains and listened to them sing, and then he could write down what they were singing, the words and music, and even published a book on that. But he'd go up in the mountains and interview them, and he realized, I don't know the exact figures, they didn't have radios there. And so he thought it would help them and the university if the university established listening centers in places where they came, you know, in the mountains, central places. I'm not sure what. I don't think
maybe
I ever.
A general store, yeah, or a school building, one room schoolhouse, perhaps.
Even. Yeah. And he and a friend, I remember, in the geology department, drove up there, and Mother said he tore up a lot of our cars driving on creek beds. And I think he enlisted in the local Rotary Club. They built a lot of toys or bought them or whatever, but they delivered toys up there in the mountains at Christmas time. I don't know how many years that went on, but it was some years. And I think it helped the university and helped the mountain people to know about the outside more.
Well, he always wanted, you know, the mission behind everything he did was education.
Yeah.
And so it stands to reason that you have all of the knowledge being exchanged and everything, research conducted at the University of Kentucky. Why not share that with all Kentuckians,
mm-hmm,
including folks who, you know, who were very isolated at that time. And the programming that came through that, he helped produce that programming with the help of WHAS radio, correct?
That sounds right, but I wasn't really that familiar with the details. I was in school growing up, but I just remember the listening centers and that he drove up there a lot.
Now, what do you remember about the Beattyville experiment that became WUKY eventually?
I don't. I really can't help on that.
Not much at all.
You'd understand it better than I would.
Uh-huh. Do you remember when they signed on the radio station in Beattyville?
No, that's just really dim in my mind.
Really dim.
Yeah, because
you would have been, I think, around 14. When they hired a woman by the name of Ruth Fox to run
the name's slightly familiar.
Okay. Uh-huh. Do you remember if your dad ever mentioned Ruth or how he?
I can't say specifically.
Yeah. The listening centers, that just it was a normal outgrowth of what he wanted to do. The idea of the publicity department, talk a little bit about how he started that.
Well, he majored in music and journalism at DePaul University, and he really used what he majored in his career. He liked to write. He was always writing articles and talks, and he had his own kind of casual style, but it was the kind that people liked. It was enjoyable. I don't know how historically correct, because I don't think he footnoted when he got to writing books about railroads.
Well, imagine the exploration and the research done on that. I must have had to ride many a rail to do that.
Yeah, they did a lot of driving on that. Let's see, he must have done the Indiana book I'm not sure. He was writing a Kentucky railroad. He got interested in abandoned railroad lines and went to a lot of places in Kentucky and interviewed people at the old depots. And Mother went with him and sat in the car, I think, while he did the interviewing. So I believe that was the first book, and then he did one in Indiana, and then finally one in Tennessee. He was always working on something. It's sad that he couldn't finish it. He died rather unexpectedly at 72.
Was it a heart attack, or was it a...
He had retired from, after being at Kentucky, I think, 26 years. I think he was 17 or 18 years at Indiana University, established a radio and television department there. What was I saying?
He passed away at 72.
Oh, yeah, why he passed away.
Right.
They traveled around the world. He had done a sabbatical before he retired in Australia and wrote a paper on the railroads of Australia, and they loved Australia. So they stayed longer on that round-the-world trip there, I think, than anywhere. And he contracted an infection in his lungs, and it spread to his heart, and finally got back to the IU Medical Department, and it damaged a heart valve. And the rest of his life, he was just gasping for breath. And I think that really led to his demise so young, that his heart had gotten weakened. I always thought that, because 72 is awfully young to die.
Absolutely.
And he was busy doing a lot of things.
He had many, many more things to accomplish that he wanted.
They retired to Sarasota, Florida. He was going to write a book on Sarasota railroads. He was interested in streetcar lines, and he was collecting information on that.
At what point did the decision to leave the University of Kentucky and go start the program at Indiana, do you know exactly what was there one particular moment where he decided, I'm going to go do this, or was it the pull of family connections?
He grew up in Madison, born there. And his wife, my mother, grew up in Frankfort. She was born in Kokomo. So they had ties, really. And I think at a lot of these broadcast conventions, he'd met a lot of people. And since he'd started the radio and television department at Kentucky, Indiana wanted that done there at University of Indiana at Bloomington. He needed a master's. For years, he didn't have one. He just had an A.B. degree from... DePaul. So he took a year and went to Illinois and got a master's degree there, and then went to Indiana. But he was at UK 26 years, and I think 17 at Indiana. So he went to a lot of these radio and television conventions and met a lot of people, really.
So the pull of the chance to go back home to Indiana, they needed what had already accomplished at UK. Just perfect the way that kind of worked out. Did he talk a lot about his days in radio and television? I mean, it sounds like railroads toward the back end of his life
took over
everything. So it might have been something that predated his interest in radio, to be honest with you.
They had an interesting railroad, Madison. It went up this real steep hill above Madison, and it was one of the steepest slopes, at least in the U.S., and he wrote an article about that. It was called Bruff's Folly. I'll give you a copy of that. That may have been the start of his interest in railroads. They had to practically pull that up with some kind of a cog system. I don't know exactly when he had so many interests. I guess when he first came to UK, it was music. He wrote several books, collection of songs. He was interested in music in college, which is no surprise. He played in a little fraternity band, played piano, and wrote an opera with some other people at DePaul. Let's see. What else did he do? Collected the music, publicity bureau.
It'd probably be easier to say what he didn't do, because he did everything.
A lot of articles in various publications, and I know he listed them if we can find that list.
Okay.
He had a sense of history, really, to put that down.
Speaking of history, we have here that Eleanor Roosevelt once
visited
campus. Do you have any memories of that? And tell us those.
Extremely dim. I remember it happened, but I don't even know if I met her. You'd think I would have. I was thinking of another thing. On the start of those railroad stories, he wrote articles for the Kentucky Colonel. Does that still exist?
Yes, it's still the student newspaper.
And I think that evolved into Ghost Railroads of Kentucky, those articles he had written.
Oh, so a string of those then became a book.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So he had a great interest in railroads, radio, television, music, publicity.
Yeah.
Just a regular Renaissance man, and yet how did he get the nickname of Bromo?
Apparently that was Lexington. I guess that was popular, Bromo Seltzer. At least it was an alcohol. Maybe Bromo was more well-known in the 20s.
Might have been.
The 30s, yeah.
So it was just a play on, it had nothing to do with his personality per se.
No, and I don't remember it carrying on into Indiana. I do remember they called him that in Lexington.
What do you remember about the radio station at the University of Kentucky after it was established, took it back to the campus? Any vivid memories of that?
Well, of course, a lot of students involved. Some of them he knew for a lifetime. He encouraged them, and I think they were grateful to him for that. He would go back there a lot of evenings, and they would do programs. He directed an orchestra, and he just seemed busy night and day.
So was there dinner time around the table, or was it grab and go?
I think we pretty much all sat down and ate. They like to entertain. I hope I'm not digressing too much.
Digressing? We want to get this on the record.
Well, every weekend, Dad would say, are we going out or are we having people in? I mean, and they do one or the other. And at home, most of the get-togethers were with friends and university professors and so forth. He'd play the piano. He had a good friend who played the guitar, another one who played the saxophone. And Dad could also play the clarinet. So the women mostly would sit around and talk, or the men who couldn't play an instrument. And he loved Broadway shows. They'd go to New York City every summer for 2 weeks to see the latest shows. And, the music was so good in those times. He loved the Gershwin music, I remember. And he knew all the popular songs. Boy, he could play. If he heard it played, he could sit down and play it. He wonderful talent musically.
Could read music and also could play by ear.
Yeah,
that is the twofold, because a lot of people can do one but not the other.
Uh huh.
And the fact that he had both going for him, I'm sure that helped him in his arrangements, arranging music. Then.
Yeah. They had a Dixieland jazz band. I know at IU, surely they had one at UK, but I can't remember. But he did, after he retired in Sarasota, organized a little band.
Now, we mentioned him creating programs on the radio. Do you remember hearing him on the radio? Did he host programs? Or
he had kind of a strange, high-pitched voice. And so I don't think he ever announced or was on the radio himself.
Interesting. So he was behind the scenes, the producer, putting things together and knowing everything.
Uh-huh.
We had just moved out of that McVeigh Hall, but there were still remnants of the major studio. They had turned it into an AV room, but you could look out through a little window and see and envision, okay, that's where the orchestra would be. That's where it would do the sound effects. And I mean, so everything was still there, even though it had been repurposed. But now the radio station's moved out of McVeigh Hall, so a little piece of that is gone. We took plenty of pictures beforehand, but
didn't they?
I could just imagine him directing everything through that glass.
At one time, didn't they have reflective surfaces, curved cardboard walls set up around to reflect the music? That was kind of probably experimental.
I think it was.
Yeah.
And the major studio still had the curved glass. We had a small production studio that we carved out of this major, massive production studio. We incorporated that curved glass, and that was ever present. It was always there, and it's still there, unless they've gutted the building. So, I mean, so much of Elmer it was still in McVeigh Hall, and it's great that we can talk about him and his legacy. Now, I did not know he had a high pitched voice.
Not real, but it was kind of strange. I think if he was treated with a drainage, that his voice would lower. Sometimes they have some kind of a treatment. But
did he smoke cigarettes?
Oh, cigars off and on. Yeah,
smoke cigars.
Yeah,
because back in the day, they would tell you if you want your voice to change, drink whiskey and smoke.
Maybe so. It was a different time.
Definitely a different time.
Yeah, my mother and sister.
Never say that to a student
nowadays. Yeah. Everybody either smoked cigarettes or cigars. There's probably other people who would know the radio history better than I would. You know,
he didn't talk too much about that at the dinner table, did he?
If he did, I don't remember it.
Mm-hmm. Well, he had so many other irons in the fire. That's the picture I'm getting. Is like, oh, I've got this radio thing, but I'm also arranging this next thing, and then we're planning my next trip to Broadway to listen to all of the new shows.
The new shows, they had seen them.
Man in Motion must not have gotten 8 hours of sleep a night.
Well, and he could work in the evening, I guess, not only at the radio station, but he'd be typing up something at home all evening. And to me, at the evening, my brain's not working. But he could keep writing.
And his wife was very
supportive.
Very supportive.
She really was. I think she was the enabler that made it life easy for him, you know, or helpful. So he
did
could,
she ever say no to him?
You know, I don't recall.
it was a team, but yeah. But whatever he wanted to do, he was going to get it done.
Yeah. They liked to travel. He was a good father. They were both good parents.
And they obviously raised their children to have an appreciation for education.
Yeah, definitely.
And so you got your master's. What about your sister, Janet?
She went 1 year to UK and then got married for about 5 years. Had a son, John, you've met him, and had to divorce him. And the parents had moved to Bloomington by then, so she went up there and went back to IU and wound up getting a doctor's degree in library science and taught for years at Indiana State at Terre Haute, Janet did.
And after going to Indiana, obviously your paths took different, your lives took different paths, but would he talk very much about what he was working on there at the radio and TV program in Indiana after he left?
No, I don't remember that at all. Mm-hmm. I've read more about it. Yeah.
And you showed me a lot of memorabilia that you saved, and there's so much of it, and it definitely gives one the impression that he was always in motion and always had something going on.
Yeah,
in different areas.
Had a lot of very, very various interests, and was always busy. But I was married, you know, and had five children and lived in another town, so we'd see each other maybe twice a year, maybe more, but. Janet was in the same town in Indiana many more years. John grew up closer to him. Have you, you've met John, haven't you?
I have not. I did not have the opportunity to meet him because we couldn't make it out there to the induction about a month ago.
He couldn't make it either.
Well, he couldn't either.
Yeah, he had to have some medical tests, so he was very disappointed.
now, he was the one that wrote the acceptance speech.
That's
correct?
Right.
And we have you, we recorded the acceptance speech. So he wrote it, and you delivered it there in Bowling Green.
Yeah.
And so your basic knowledge of the listening centers is pretty much what you can I definitely remember all of
mm-hmm.
it. Did you ever go visit a listening center?
Mm-mm, never did.
And did your dad say, "Oh, don't you, I don't want you going with me"?
No, I don't think it was ever mentioned. He went with some other professors at UK and some Rotary friends, I'm sure. I would doubt if he went by himself when I think about it.
Well, there's an interesting, he had written down, we have a transcript of an oral history interview that he did where he talked about coming across a mountain individual who asked him to drink moonshine with him, and when he refused, he pulled a gun on him.
That's funny, isn't it? I never heard that.
You never heard that? Uh-uh. I have. I can show you the transcript because I've got it right here in my lap.
Well, think of that.
So maybe we'll do. Maybe we'll swap. You give me some documents, I'll give you some.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to know about that.
Yeah.
That made me think. He took the band to Paintsville for the Mountain Laurel Festival. I think they had that every year, but I remember that.
So how did that? How did that work out?
I don't know the details.
Okay. I'll dig up that
I guess it was Middlesboro, isn't it? I'm not sure where they had that festival.
Mountain Laurel?
Yeah.
Yeah. We can look that up.
Okay.
We will look that up. So, yeah, I'm getting the picture of a rich, rich life, very happy with his accomplishments, had much more left to do, was working on
yes.
railroad books, anything else that he was working on at that time after he got back from Australia?
Electric lines, what do you call them?
In
Urbans and stuff. I've gone blank on it. The electric lines that were in the cities.
Mm-hmm. Old power grids? Oh, trolleys.
Trolleys.
Trolleys, right, okay. Yes.
He was going to do it a different way from the railroad. He was asking people who lived in the specific areas, and it included Kentucky and Indiana, I know, to write the chapters. And he died in the middle of that, and I tried to carry on with his notes, but people didn't come through that he thought would. And I thought, Dad, this is a mistake to count on others. You need to do it yourself.
Well, he was a take-charge individual, though, right?
Uh-huh.
If it's going to happen, it's
going to. Yeah, he would have known how to make it work, but I wasn't able to.
He was a great piano player, great organ
yeah.
player. We mentioned that he could play by ear and also read music. Obviously, band leader. So even when he was entertaining, I'm sure he, you know, holidays were pretty much bring everybody over and we sing Christmas songs, Christmas carols.
I don't remember specifically, but I bet we did. That organ he bought, I think, he loved theater organs. He got it from somewhere where it was not being used and reassembled it at UK and taught himself to play.
Got oh, really?
Picture. I'll show you.
Okay.
It's right over here.
All
righty.
I'm almost out of batteries, but. Oh, yes. Now, I have this. Somebody sent me a picture of this in an email. I think it was Jamie.
Oh, good, yeah. Mother had written on the back of it, February 1 of 1976. He died February 15th. So it's right before he died.
Goodness, like 2 weeks before his death.
I'm so glad Mother wrote that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is a beautiful
That's in order. Sarasota.
When did he move to Sarasota?
Let me think. Okay. He was 66 when he retired. That'd been 1969. They moved about then. What was I going to say? Oh, this is not the one he built. It would be at the studios, I imagine.
Okay. Still at W, or somewhere on the University of Kentucky campus then, somewhere.
I could play the piano by reading. I never could do it by ear. I wish I could have. Mm-hmm. But I took organ lessons for years from the church organist, and to think he just sat out and played it.
Oh, yeah.
And the pedals, too.
Like I said, it's easier to describe the things that he couldn't do
than
it was to describe what he could do.
Yeah,
take a lot less time. Was he a type of individual where he never met a stranger?
I would say so. He was always optimistic. He always joked around. He loved puns. He liked to play bridge. I guess that's one of the things they do on Saturday nights. Had his own bridge system, and I'm sure he drove everybody crazy because he didn't follow the rules.
He made up his own rules.
Or if he picked up a bad hand, he'd groan loudly. But I felt like when he came into a room, he really lit it up. He had that kind of personality. I have a son, Kent, who reminds me of Dad.
same.
You just want him to come in. You want to sit down and talk to him.
And I'm sure it served him well in talking and interacting with all kinds of different people throughout his life.
Yeah, he might have offended somebody. If he did, I don't know about it.
And did he, I don't want to say mellowed with age, but I mean, obviously got a new perspective on things after retirement. Sounds like he really didn't slow down, though, at all.
I didn't have that impression. He joined some groups in Sarasota. I think he was on the board of the Red Cross. He was with a writer's group in Sarasota. McKinley Cantor was one of them, some well-known writers.
Well, I have this this transcript, and I will. And we have lots of copies of this, so I will give this to you.
Thank you.
This is this is some of the questions that I asked you are based off of what he said there, and the one I was a knee slapper was the one where he was talking about the. You know, you will have a drink with me.
Isn't that funny? I don't think I ever heard that.
He probably would not have mentioned that at home.
Might have scared Mother.
It might have, because that was a hard scrabble existence for a lot of folks out there. He said they didn't really take kindly to strangers.
Yeah.
And that was a way of, that was a social invitation. If you have a drink with me, I can trust you.
And
I can let my guard down a little bit. And when your dad politely declined, that upped the ante a little bit.
And that was insulting.
Yeah, I don't want to say a personal affront, but
so it's a tape. Yeah, I'd like to.
And
look at that.
We have not been able to find that tape. The University of Kentucky does not have it. We checked also with Indiana, and they don't have it.
Where'd you get it?
We just have the transcript.
Oh.
So somewhere, somehow.
I'm going to need a big clip.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, yes. Grab you one of these. I did many of those when I turned in assignments getting my master's. So, we have that. That is certain. That has circulated. That's in the University of Kentucky's archives. So we will.
I've got some tapes I wanted to show you.
Okay.
It's on the table, but I don't know if you think that's about all you.
I think we've covered just about everything.
Okay.
Was there anything else that you wanted me to to talk about or ask you about that needs to go into?
No, I guess I could kind of give the personality, which I just did.
Uh-huh.
I think he considered himself shy, but he never showed it. I mean, he was always outgoing, and I think people took to him.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm blown away by just the different interests and how he was able to pursue them all. You know, maybe not completely to satisfaction, but he did more than dabble, let's face it. Anything that he got into, he got into, not just...
Well, he had talents. He could write well and play music well, and he used those talents.
Okay, so what I want to do now is we will end the formal interview. I'll change the batteries, and then I'm just going to keep the thing rolling, and you're going to describe some of the memorabilia that you have, and we can use that. We can use transcripts of that as well.
Well, you will edit it.
Absolutely.
Herein ends the interview.
Word if you won't agree to edit it.